everyone. I'm calling to order the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade meeting for Monday, February 27th. And we are going to begin with an informational hearing, and then we're going to move into introduction of some committee bills. I'd like to call forward Jeff Hampton, Vice President of Operations at Travel Oregon, to discuss Oregon's tourism sector and its importance to our economy. And then after that, we're going to be following up with some interesting thoughts by people in the Oregon cannabis sector about the potential opportunities for cannabis tourism and some predicate steps that they think are important if we want to move forward at some point with that. Mr. Hampton, welcome. Please state your name for the record and share your thoughts with us.
Well, thank you so much, Chair Leininger and committee members. My name is Jeff Hampton, Vice President of Operations with Travel Oregon. Thrilled to be able to be here today to share a little bit with you about Oregon's tourism economy and the tourism industry in our state. So thank you for that opportunity. I have a few slides presented. I was told to keep this presentation to an hour and 45 minutes, so I'll try to shorten it right down from there. We'll whittle it down a little bit. I've got about 10 slides or thereabouts, so I'll move through this fairly quickly. If there are questions, of course, at any time, feel free to let me know, but happy to answer questions at the end or following this committee time as well. I thought I'd start with just a brief overview of Oregon's travel and tourism industry and share with you, you know, in Oregon and in most states in the country, when we think about a visitor, it's somebody who travels at least 50 miles from their place of residence and or has an overnight stay at a commercial lodging establishment. And when we think about the impact of the travel and tourism industry and who is employed in the industry in Oregon, it really reaches across all corners of the state and touches nearly every community. We have direct employment of just over 105,000 Oregonians in 2015, and those are employees at restaurants and wineries, hotels, and the businesses that you might think of most immediately when you think about travel and tourism. There are also positions that are supported indirectly, and that is jobs that are supported by visitor spending and visitor economic activity in communities. And those might be sales at retail or gas stations, galleries, those sorts of things that visitors will visit and frankly play an important part in the profitability of many of those businesses in communities.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
Excuse me for interrupting so early, but I think Mr. Hampton's left out one of the most important segments of the benefits of our tourism economy. And that's not just the employees and the spinoff businesses, but the fact that we have the opportunity to create small businesses, and we have owners that are moving forward, not employees, but owners who are starting their own enterprises and building a sustainable future for themselves and their families and their employees.
Representative Gomber and Chair Leininger, thank you for making that point. I'm sorry I was remiss in not saying so. But in fact, as we bring people to Oregon, whether it be for leisure travel or business travel, those are opportunities to sell the state to potential employers who often do relocate here or make decisions to expand businesses. And there are Oregonians that are homegrown as well that absolutely see this as the place that they want to run their business. And it is an important aspect of it. Thank you for breaking that point. I'll take you back to Oregon's history just briefly. It was in 2003, House Bill 2267 was passed as the tourism investment proposal. At the time, prior to 2004, Oregon ranked 47th in the nation in terms of state investment in travel and tourism as an economic strategy directly. The bill that passed was a way to help recognize the market share that Oregon was losing to other states, our lack of ability to compete, and the recognition that Oregon needed a economic stimulus. The U.S. Travel Association, just for point of reference, in 2015 has identified that the average state tourism budget is $18 million. The states that have the highest tourism budgets, the top six are probably no big surprise, Florida, Hawaii, California, Illinois, Texas, and New York. The state with the lowest tourism budget in terms of the state direct investment is our neighbors to the north at Washington State, who in 2011 had their tourism office closed. Their budget was the lowest in the U.S. The U.S. average of $18 million is right on par with where Oregon is currently. In the current biennium, our budget is right at about $36 million, so we're right about at the average. In 2003, when the bill passed, we were 47th. We then moved to 27th shortly following that in terms of our state investment. And, of course, there's no telling what other states will do as it relates to their strategies going forward. I do want to remind you as well that it's important as a state agency that we also support Oregon's tourism regions, regions and local economies. And when the bill passed in 2003, and this was addressed again last year in 2016, Oregon's seven tourism regions, as we identify them, also saw a reinvestment of resource when the legislature saw fit to dedicate 20% of the state transient lodging tax that comes to Travel Oregon to help implement a regional tourism program to support regional and local tourism priorities. In addition to that, Travel Oregon has administered a grant program for several years. That is also an opportunity for us to get resource out to local communities and to, into Oregon's regions. In the past 6 years, our grant program has grown from $62,000 to $120,000. Our commission in the current biennium adopted a budget that had $500,000 in grant monies to be awarded to regional and local entities for tourism investment projects. And again, last year with House Bill 4146, the legislature increased the grant program to 10% of the statewide transient lodging tax. And I share all of this just to share that the investment in tourism isn't just at the state level. We're also using these state dollars to help support local and regional tourism priorities. A quick look, if you would, at the revenue picture for travel and tourism in Oregon. You can see that for 2015, visitor spending, the economic impacts came in at $10.8 billion, the highest level we've seen to date. You'll note that obviously after 2008, with the financial crash and the impacts on the economy, the travel and tourism industry in Oregon also saw a decline, but we've seen significant and sustained growth since that period. I mentioned direct industry employment being at 105,600 employees in Oregon, and as Representative Gomberg mentioned, those are businesses that are also supported, and we hope to see more investment in tourism through private sector business as well. If we took a look at the change in spending annually by region, as again we look at the state and seven tourism regions, you can see that each of the seven regions realized growth in visitor spending year over year. The highest region that to realize that spending increase being the greater Portland region that you see at 7.1%, and the lowest region, but still, while modest growth, still growth, Eastern Oregon at 2.3%. If we look at the average growth in demand, that is demand for lodging rooms at commercial establishments, and this is from Smith Travel Research, you'll see that demand has also increased both of the last 2 years as well, with the 8.5% increase in the Hood Gorge region, as we identify it, and the coast coming in at 3.4% increase in demand as well.
Manager.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Quick question. One slide back.
Yes.
The change, only because my good friend Representative Gomberg is from one of those portions of the coast. By chance, do you, off the top of your head, even have like a, that's the whole coast.
That's the whole coast.
Is it, do you ever break it into north, south, middle?
Representative Post and committee members, Chair Leininger, we do. In fact, the Department of Revenue identifies 10 regions that they collect tax from, three of which are on the coast. The distinction between their 10 and our 7 is they break the coast into three regions. The North Coast spending increased 4.4%, Central Coast 4.2%, and the South Coast at 3.4%. And I can show you, I don't have it with me today, but I can sure be happy to provide for you how we break out the North, Central, and South according to Department of Revenue.
I think that just right there, those numbers, that's fantastic. Thank you.
You bet. My pleasure.
Thanks.
Again, just a quick picture at the U.S. summary of forecast. I share this with you just to give you some sense of what the U.S. Travel Association is forecasting for the travel and tourism industry going forward. You can see a distinction between leisure and business travel, sometimes considered group travel as well. Travel Oregon primarily focuses on leisure travel, both domestic and internationally. Our responsibility and role as we take it on includes support for business and group travel, but we really focus on the leisure travel market primarily. And you can see that with both leisure and domestic, the forecast from U.S. Travel Association is for an increase in visitation and an increase in spending, both domestically and from international travelers coming to the United States as well. I share the international numbers because international visitors are an important part of Oregon's travel mix. While the lion's share of our economic impact comes from domestic travel, the international travelers do play an important part, and there are important trade partnerships in many cases that are supported through travel as well. I would share with you that international travel to the U.S. Is up 46 million more overnight stays internationally last year versus 2015, and of note, this is the seventh consecutive year of sustained growth. That sort of an uninterrupted run of growth hasn't happened since the 1960s. If we bring it a little closer to home and look at international arrivals and travel to Oregon, I do want to point out, while there's an awful lot of numbers here, I'll point to just two of these. That is that our largest international market is and continues to be Canada. It's, of course, an important market for Oregon, and we continue to focus on the Canadian market as important partners that way. I would point out also, if you take a look, Japan was our largest overseas international market until 2014, at which point China has now surpassed Japan in terms of visitation to Oregon. And you'll see the growth if you follow the line across there, the row, for Chinese inbound visitors to Oregon. There's been significant growth that continues, I won't say exponentially, but at a pretty good clip. We expect that will continue as the Chinese government continues to allow their population to travel around the world. We think we're well positioned in Oregon here on the Pacific Rim to really capitalize on the Asia market, and China is a great opportunity for Oregon as well. Smith Travel Research is a firm that is internationally known for their work around the lodging sector in particular in terms of forecasting and working on providing information on the health of the industry. And there's an awful lot of information here as well that I know you'll have access to. I would just point out that Smith Travel Research is forecasting for 2017 that occupancy rates in Oregon, that is at commercial lodging, are forecast to remain effectively flat. And while they are forecasting an increase in revenue, you'll note that they're predicting that that increase will largely be driven by increases in average rate. So in other words, lodging providers increasing their rate as demand remains strong, rate increases, and of course, we'll realize the benefits of that as well. Specifically to the Oregon Tourism Commission and Travel Oregon's forecast for the balance of 2016 fiscal, 2016-17, and then into 2018. We wanted to show this graph to show the continued growth that Oregon's tourism industry continues to realize through the investments of tourism through Travel Oregon, as well as our local and regional partners, their investments, along with private business investments in the state in promoting and marketing Oregon as a destination. This assumes a tax rate held at 1% so that you could see the trajectory in an apples-to-apples sort of way. Of course, the tax rate is now at 1.8%, and there's about a six-month lag between collections from the Department of Revenue and when Travel Oregon actually sees those dollars, depending on when the lodging properties remit their tax, and then that's processed and distributed to Travel Oregon for use in promoting Oregon. I would end with this slide. It's a bit of a recap. Again, a picture back to the original investment in tourism as a strategy and where we are today as it relates to four key indicators, and that being employment, earnings, visitor spending, and state and local taxes. And we've seen significant growth in all of those by all of those measures over the past 12 years. Chair Leininger and committee members, that wraps up my prepared remarks. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions or provide follow-up information as needed.
That's excellent. Rep. Marsh, and then Rep. Reschke, and then Rep. Gomberg.
Thank you, Chair. You gave us a good picture of the impact and the importance of international travel here. I have read in popular publications that in 2017 we're seeing a significant drop in the number of people who are looking at international flights, potentially booking. Do you have any data on that at this point?
Representative Marsh and Chair Leininger, we don't have specific data on that yet, but there certainly is uncertainty. I'm not sure that's the best turn of phrase, but there is an awful lot of question about the impacts on international travel going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that has to do with diplomatic relations.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it has to do with world economies, of course, and availability of spending by those international travelers. We don't have information specific to it. To this point, U.S. Travel and Smith Travel Research have not indicated a decline or a change in their forecast. They're still seeing growth in international travel. What that may look like as the year continues on, we'll be able to provide updates to that as we learn more.
Good. Thank you.
You bet. My pleasure.
Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming. The international arrivals to Oregon, there was a slide back there that showed Canada being top, and I was surprised that there's that many people in Canada. No, I'm just teasing. I'm half Canadian, so. I wanted to know if there was, if this is business travel and recreational or tourism travel, or if it's both, and do you have that broken out if it is both?
Representative Reschke and Chair Leininger, I don't have that broken out here for you today. I can certainly work with the port to try to get at that information as well. But this does include both leisure and business travel, or front and back of the plane, as you
okay,
might say.
Okay, right. Okay, that's fine. I just wanted to understand the numbers better.
You bet.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, good morning, Mr. Hampton. There is a growing awareness, and appropriately so, that Oregon may well experience a major seismic event in the future. Is there evidence that that is affecting visits to Oregon and our tourism industry?
Representative Gomberg and Chair Leininger, committee members, we don't have any evidence that that has created a negative impact on visitation to the Oregon coast specifically or to Oregon, but the Cascadia subduction zone and the press about it and the reality of a potential cataclysmic event like that, I think it's a reality we have to consider. We do work with local and regional tourism entities to talk about how businesses can be prepared to help get visitors to safe locations in the event of. But to this point, we don't have any data to show that it's created a negative impact.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. What we don't want to see is an advertising campaign that says, come see Oregon while it's still here.
There you go. I think that's a good point. All right. I'd love to ask a question, please, about cannabis tourism. When I was growing up in the Rogue Valley, wine tourism and the wine industry was an important piece of revitalizing the economy there after big changes in the natural resource economy. And I think the cannabis sector, it's my impression that the cannabis sector has been an important economic driver there and in some other parts of the state, particularly since Measure 91 passed. Can you tell us anything about the economic value of cannabis tourism in states like Colorado that have been early into that legal market? And can you tell us about steps that your organization is taking to support appropriate growth and opportunity in tourism in the cannabis sector in Oregon?
Absolutely. Well, I'll take a shot. I'll have a better answer for the second part of that than the first, I'm afraid, Representative Leininger and committee members. We are actively looking at the impacts of cannabis tourism on the recreation sector and on travel and tourism in the other states that have adopted it in a fashion that's similar to Oregon's decisions around it. I don't have information to share specifically. I certainly can get that for you. I didn't come with that today. I will tell you there has been increases in tax revenues realized in Take the state of Colorado as an example. But I'm not prepared to speak to what some of the additional costs were that they've realized that might offset some of those net tax gains. That I can't speak to. I will tell you, as an agency, we have not taken a formal position on cannabis tourism. It is, if you'll excuse the pun, a growing sector. There is significant interest. There's no question about that. But we as a state agency have not yet taken a position or posted any sort of a campaign or campaign-related materials specific to travel to Oregon with cannabis as an impetus for that travel. We've not taken that position. To a great extent, we're waiting on, I would suggest, the governor's office to help us with some direction around how they'd like us to pursue or not pursue as a state agency that. We have not yet done so. I will tell you that, again, we do recognize there's significant interest. The question, again, is whether the interest is, as an impetus for the travel, is the fact that Oregon has cannabis available in a recreational form under limited use guidelines. Is that an impetus for folks to travel to Oregon, or is it something that folks do while they're here in Oregon? And that's something we're not prepared. We don't have enough information to determine whether or not it is a significant impetus for travel. But it certainly is something that we're considering as an agency as well.
Okay. Well, thank you. I would I'd like to suggest that It's my understanding is that it has been a significant impetus for people to do to travel to other states, including Colorado. And as we continue to try to grow our tourism sector, it seems like that's one of the assets we really have. And the state is already deeply engaged in expending state resources to regulate and deal with the sector. So it's not as if it would be changing the level of engagement by the state in dealing with this legal sector. But I appreciate very much that you appropriately need to have guidance from colleagues in your executive branch work. So really appreciate your thoughtful comments on that, and appreciate all the information you've brought to us today. Any additional comments for the speaker? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Let us know how we can be supportive of your efforts as we move forward, because that's the goal of this committee, to try to create jobs and opportunity by supporting small business growth and development of market share in key sectors like yours. Thanks.
Chair Leininger, thank you.
All right. So with that, we will welcome forward Sam Chapman with New Economy Consulting, Vince Porter of the Oregon Cannabis Association, and Aviv Hadar with OriGrown to discuss the cannabis sector in Oregon's tourism context, and also something called social consumption, for which there are a couple of bills pending, folks. And I know that not everyone on this committee may see the issue in the same way, but one of the goals of the Speaker's office this legislative session is to help make sure that members of the legislature outside of the Joint Marijuana Regulation Committee are starting to hear more about the issues, the opportunities, the needs of this legal sector. And so part of what we're doing is providing that kind of background in the context of a couple of bills that are proposed for the other committee for you this session. So welcome, gentlemen. I see there are two of you, which is great, but...
Yeah, Chair Leininger, unfortunately, Aviv is stuck over in Bend and was not able to make it over the hill today.
God, you want to go first?
Okay. Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Vince Porter. I'm a lobbyist for the firm Strategies 360, and we represent the Oregon Cannabis Association. The Oregon Cannabis Association is comprised of over 100 cultivators, processors, edible makers, dispensaries, and other allied businesses focused on cannabis businesses around Oregon. As Oregon and other states move beyond prohibition, we see clear and sensible regulation that promotes health and safety in our communities, excellence in our products and services, and compliance at every level. One of Oregon Cannabis Association's top priorities is a clear framework for public consumption for cannabis for adults. We understand that it's in the public interest to have defined limits regarding consumption so that those who are consuming and those who are enforcing the laws are working on the same from the same page. And we've heard from many of our members, and from what we hear on the ground, there's a disconnect between the current law and practice happening around the state that needs to be addressed. It's OCA's goal for Oregon to continue to move towards 100% legal adult use cannabis consumption. And in order to achieve that goal, the social consumption issue is something we feel must be resolved. We also believe that clear social consumption regulations can be an economic development tool around the state. It would allow us to enable safe and professional events and clear direction for our out-of-state tourists who choose to come to Oregon to partake in our legal cannabis consumption laws. And if you want to see how that industry can have a broad economic impact, you need to only look at the state of Colorado. For it was in 2015, it was a record year in Colorado where with more than 1 million visitors attended Colorado than ever previously before. Certainly, we would not assume that all these are attributed to the legalization of marijuana, but certainly had a significant impact. And in 2016, Colorado surpassed $1 billion in legal sales, thanks in part to intentional marketing efforts by the private sector to attract tourists. Clarity in the public consumption laws would allow Oregon to responsibly organize events and designated areas for consumption use. But it would also provide clarity for those tourists who are coming who choose not to participate in the marijuana industry, and provide clarity for our local governments of where marijuana use could be consumed and also not consumed. Lastly, I would say that while if the state chooses not to market, I think that there's evidence around in the other states where they're legal that markets will develop their own opportunities. If you just look at Colorado, all around the state they have cannabis tours. They're developed by the private sector and other efforts, and clearly there has been success from their efforts. So I know Sam has developed the public the consumption bills that are before us, so I will defer to Sam to go into details about the issue further.
Thank you. And so we'll invite Mr. Chapman to speak, and then we can have questions afterwards. Really appreciate you both being here and adding this kind of perspective on the tourism sector and economic growth opportunities.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sam Chapman. I run a cannabis consulting firm based out of Portland, Oregon, and I've been working on crafting and navigating cannabis rules and regulations here in Oregon for about the last 8 years. So I'm going to do a quick overview of the tourism industry in general here in Oregon and get into a little more specifics about Senate Bill 307, which is what we're referring to as a social consumption bill. So. Really quickly, here's a couple of the subjects we're going to go over. Perspectives from the national local cannabis industries, current tax revenue statistics from the Department of Revenue, job creation, barriers to future growth, and then opportunities. So how big is the national cannabis industry? It was most recently cited by an ArcView Market Research report that the current annual sales reported in 2016 were $6.9 billion. And overall, by 2020, we're looking at a $17 billion industry. So here's some statistics from here in Oregon. This is updated as of a couple days ago from the Department of Revenue. As you can see, the chart starts in February 2016, was when we really started to see the adult use of cannabis sales go up as a result of Measure 91 fully kicking in and OLCC licenses coming on board. You'll see that it's actually started to go down, which I think is something that everyone should be kind of curious about. I think that there's a lot of reasons why some of that is going down. There's a regulatory transition that's been happening. There have obviously been a lot of questions in general about the industry, but overall, we've seen steady growth, and I think that this chart is an indication that the more that we can look at the cannabis industry from a tourism perspective and as an opportunity to bring in additional tax revenue in a time where Oregon is very pressed to find new avenues for that revenue, I think this is something to be watching very carefully as we move forward. So again, some more statistics. This is Similar to the chart that we saw earlier about where the revenue is coming from, you can see that obviously Portland, being the largest area in Oregon in terms of population-wise, is bringing in a good amount of tax revenue. Please do notice that this is only based on grams of flour sold. That is currently the number one product that is being purchased. It is by no means the entirety of the market. I would suspect that over the years, we'll start to see more innovation within the products of the cannabis industry. New demographics will be coming online, whether it be, you know, I personally think soccer moms and grandparents are going to be the new users of cannabis 3 to 5 years from now because of the different products that are coming out that are not necessarily containing THC, but that do provide health remedies for people who would not have otherwise thought of themselves as in need of medical marijuana. But the adult use of cannabis is being seen more and more every day as a health remedy for many issues in general. So you can also note that Southern Oregon is fairly low in terms of incoming tax. I think that's interesting in that a large majority, I think, of the cannabis grown in Oregon is from Southern Oregon. And I think that tourism in general is already starting to happen in Southern Oregon, but not quite in a way that it could. And I think that there's a lot of room for improvement, especially in Southern Oregon. You can see that Willamette Valley has a significant number of tax dollars coming in. I think that there's something to be said for the fact that it's in the same area as the wine industry. I think there are going to be a lot of parallels that we're going to see with the cannabis industry and the wine and craft beer industry and the craft coffee industry and every other craft industry that we are proud to have here in Oregon. So in 2015, I partnered up with Bo Whitney and a couple of researchers to create the Oregon Cannabis Jobs Report. I should note that these numbers are old. They are from 2015, but it's about the newest, the most up-to-date numbers we have. And I am working with other people in state government to try and restart a new survey to keep an ongoing track of how many jobs are being created within the cannabis industry. As of 2015, we did a sample of just retailers. And this was before full adult use cannabis came online. And there were 2,156 jobs just created in the retail sector. That does not include cultivation. That does not include processing. That does not include wholesale. That does not include the hundreds of different sectors of ancillary jobs, attorneys, construction, architects, whatever it may be. We are seeing the ripple effects of the cannabis industry go through almost every different type of service industry that you could provide. The cannabis industry needs those jobs as well. So again, initially we saw $46 million in wages being paid out in 2015 under just retail. That was an initial market of about $300 million. And the increase that we saw right when we made the change when adults could start purchasing cannabis at medical dispensaries, as long as they were 21, was 112% increase. I'm sure we've seen an increase of that even more as OLCC licenses have come online. Again, here are some of the specific numbers in terms of projections that I think are probably somewhat different today based on regulatory hurdles that the industry is facing, but overall, we're starting to see a lot of full-time and part-time jobs come online here in Oregon just because of the cannabis industry's evolution. So barriers, cute corgi, jumping over barrier. Overregulation. This is happening a lot at the local level. Specifically in Portland has seen a lot of hurdles in terms of fees to get into the industry. You know, understandably, there has been concern about illegal market competing with the legal market. And I think that there have been a lot of good regulations that are in place, mostly from the state level. Thank you. But at the local level, there are still cities that are getting big homework assignments for the first time that have never been tasked with regulating a new industry before. So we're seeing some hurdles. I'm sure they will get smoothed out. There are some cities who have allowed cannabis use but have such strict regulations that there's no physical place that you could put a cannabis business in their locality. We call those de facto bans. I'm happy to talk about those if you have questions. I know that there are some ideas floating around taxation. I think that, again, I can't think of any other industry that is more willing to be taxed right now than the cannabis industry. And I think there's something to be said for that. At the same time, it's very important that we balance out where the right level of taxation is. Cannabis is an elastic product, just like many products that we talk about here in the legislature, and meaning that when price goes up, demand goes down and vice versa. And so, you know, I just want it to be known and for everyone to keep a close eye on the fact that if we go too far in allowing certain local governments to enact taxes before we figure out where the plateau is, you know, we could actually make less tax revenue. I'm a firm believer that if taxes are low, sales will be higher, and thus the state of Oregon will gain more revenue. And I think there's a lot of people out there in the Department of Revenue and in the industry that are very interested in working on that concept moving forward to ensure that we get as much tax revenue as possible here in Oregon from the cannabis industry and tourism in general. And last but not least, responsible consumption and events. As Vince had noted, there's kind of a conundrum right now. You can buy cannabis, you can grow it, you can share it, you can consume it if you own your own home. There is no other legal avenue for you to consume cannabis right now. So I've talked with people in terms of, you know, airline attendants to taxi drivers, to people that run concierge at hotels, to cannabis retail dispensaries that get asked this question every single day. Where can I go use this product that I just bought? Or once I get to Oregon, where can I consume this product safely and legally? There's serious hesitation from people. That is going to result in less sales being made. And I think that Senate Bill 307 is a solution to that, which we'll get to in a second. But examples of different types of events, social consumption, opportunities that the state of Oregon has, right? So cannabis weddings are a thing. They're actually happening. Some of them are happening within Oregon, but more or less in a gray area. There are things that you can and cannot do in terms of giving out cannabis, and Senate Bill 307 would be a direct solution to some of those gray areas. Concerts. This is Red Rocks in just outside of Denver, Colorado. There are plenty of people that would love to be able to go to a concert and instead of drinking beer, enjoy cannabis. I think there's plenty of arguments that would also say that there would probably be less fights at concerts if this were to happen. Now, that's just anecdotal, but I just want to toss it out there. Cooking classes. The creativity within the industry is really starting to boom here in Oregon and in other states that have legal cannabis. There are a lot of people that do not enjoy smoking cannabis. There are a lot of foodies out there that come to Oregon just to experience the food. And combining cannabis with that food experience, I think we have, again, another opportunity to encourage people and allow them to enjoy cannabis in a new Oregon craft setting. And last, but definitely not least, cannabis-friendly hotels and places where people can actually stay. If you don't necessarily want to go to an event, you want to have a peaceful, quiet time at the beach, and you want to be able to feel good about legally consuming cannabis in your Airbnb or wherever it is, there should be places where you can do this. I think that there are plenty of hotels on the coast that, or hotels in general, that would rather have their customers go to a designated place where they can consume cannabis instead of consuming it in their rooms, where they're actually going to end up subjecting other customers, children, parents, people that do not want to be subjected to cannabis smoke in the hotel. They might be doing it anyways, and that's unfortunate. Those people should have a safe place to go. So Senate Bill 307, specifically, it's pretty straightforward. It creates two new license types under the OLCC. One is for cannabis lounges. It's pretty much exactly what you think it would be. It's a place where people can go. They could either bring their own or they could purchase from a dispensary nearby, and they could safely consume their cannabis within that premise. There's fairly broad rulemaking authority for the OLCC because this is something that I've been working with the OLCC on for a while. This is not something we wanted to spring on them. This is something that we want to be hand in hand with them on, and we currently feel that that is the situation as of right now. It basically allows local governments to opt in. So this is really important in that it does not force any locality to have to have these licenses. The idea is that this is an incremental approach. If the city of Portland, which has been on record supporting Senate Bill 307, wants to have these licenses, which they do, they should be able to craft rules and regulations on their own with the OLCC to really start looking at this issue in a tangible, physical matter. I believe that the city of Portland will be a great pilot city to examine how the future of cannabis tourism in Oregon can really work, not just here in Oregon, but across the entire state. It was mentioned in the previous Travel Oregon presentation that there are there's concern about losing market share in tourism in general to other states, right? California just legalized. Nevada is coming online as well. I mean, those guys are not new to tourism. And this will be something that they are seriously considering. And there will be market share to be had or market share to be lost in terms of cannabis tourism, in terms of the timelines of other states coming online. So the other thing about the problem that 307 solves, again, as we've mentioned, people don't have places to consume. Now, who are these people? Medical cannabis patients often do not have places to consume. Senate Bill 307 had one hearing in the Marijuana Regulation Committee a couple weeks ago, and there are cancer patients who cannot legally smoke in their home. I'm also a real estate agent in Portland, and I'm very aware of 99.5% of every lease, it forbids you to smoke cannabis in your home or often even possess it. We are criminalizing people who we otherwise thought we've given the permission to consume their own cannabis, whether it's medically or for adults in their own home. Again, this is people in Section 8 housing. If you're in federal housing, no go. Again, marijuana retailers, alcohol retailers who are faced with potentially losing their liquor licenses if people decide to try and, you know, sneakily, you know, use cannabis on premise out back or something. I think, you know, if you've been to a bar in one of the major cities, maybe you've probably seen that. That's no good. We want to be able to separate that and create a legal space. Again, parents who don't necessarily want to subject their children, things of that nature. There are a lot of people who are currently being affected by this. And lastly, again, tourists, they have no idea where to do this. I've actually heard directly from retailers and people who work at dispensaries saying that, well, we either tell them there's nowhere they can go, or you just go around the corner, or there's a park two blocks down the road, or just go park somewhere and smoke in your car. That's not what we want people to be doing here in Oregon. There is a lack of education and a lack of safe legal spaces for these people to go, and Senate Bill 307 provides a legitimate, pragmatic solution to that. Again, I already talked about local policy. It's an opt-in. It allows cities that are very interested in this to take the lead, and I think that actually goes hand-in-hand with another bill that creates a social consumption task force to really look into this issue further. If there is a city that is going forward with this concept and we have the task force in hand, I think it gives the task force the real ammunition that they need to decide whether or not this is something that we really want to run with. And I think those are kind of two bills that go very well together. Again, why now? Additional tax revenue. I think everyone's very aware of the current situation that the state of Oregon is in, and I think that the state would be remiss to not closely examine every single opportunity. I mean, I recently think I saw a bill introduced for taxing coffee. We're at that level, it seems like, to where we're unturning every single leaf. Let's unturn the cannabis leaf here and see how much tax revenue we can find. And again, more tax revenue, right? So again, I will leave it at that. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Representative Post.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chair, I appreciate this testimony. So there's several things, Sam, that you said that, look, I'm not going to solve this here, and this committee is not going to solve this here. This is for other discussions. But the thing that I've thought about is, and I'm all for people doing whatever they want. It's great. Not this very legislature, but this very building created the Indoor Clean Air Act.
Yep.
And my problem is, so the concert, the Red Rocks, mm-hmm. Okay? I've been to a million concerts in my life. I'm a rock and roll DJ for 30 years. So believe me, I've smelled dope everywhere I went. It's always been. It always will be.
Right.
Okay. But the smoke was what bothered me. Beer doesn't get on me
sure.
from my next door neighbor. So if people can consume it in a way that's not smoke, then I think there would be a lot more open. So everything that was talked about in Senate Bill 307, and I'm going to be interested in that conversation, is there's secondhand smoke. How do we? So unless you do create a lounge, and which, by the way, we've created that with cigar shops.
Right.
Cigar shops have all of the rules and criteria to make to where you would go into that place and you know, it's ventilated, it's all those various different things. So I'd like to see that done.
Right.
But I'm afraid of things like this tourism idea, because if there's somebody there that doesn't want secondhand smoke, you're forbidding them from coming in a way. So you see where I'm going with all this? This legislature, not again this particular one, but the legislature has very clearly said we're against smoking. Not what kind of smoking, not one kind of smoking is better than another kind of smoking, but smoking is bad. I'll go one step further. I spend a lot of time in Hawaii. Hawaii recently, January 1st of 2015, I found out, much to my chagrin, when I sat on my beach that I always go to and lit up a cigar and was told you can't smoke on the beach. I said, if I walk out 50 feet in the water up to here, can I smoke out there? Nope, that's still the beach. So there's no smoking anywhere. So I'm not sure where we can go with this. The other part about that I thought was fascinating was, and this is just a message I hope that you can give to everybody in this building, if we lower taxes, we'll raise more revenue. Cigarettes, cigars, we have bills in this legislature to raise taxes on cigarettes and cigars, but lower taxes on marijuana. I don't like that connection. Let's lower it all. So I'm with you on what you said. Let's lower the taxes and create more revenue. Absolutely. But I'm just wondering, what would you do about the secondhand smoke issue?
Absolutely. Yep. Chair Leininger, Representative Post, that's an excellent question. I'm glad that you asked it. Currently, that is the big conundrum and where the majority of opposition is coming from right now, is people who have understandably worked very hard, to get the Indoor Clean Act where it is. And I think that the big point that I think, I'm trying really hard to make is that Senate Bill 307 actually embodies the philosophy of the Indoor Clean Air Act, and that we're removing where people are currently smoking in public, in parks, outside of businesses, around children, and putting it in a place where actually it's less likely to subject people to smoke, right? In terms of the temporary events, I think that's a great question too. I think that, in general, you would have a smoking section. You would not necessarily be condoning smoking a joint front row at a concert, right? I envision much more of a designated area like a beer garden, right? And if you wanted to, and again, this is why we left the rules very open for the OLCC to help interpret, so we can work with the legislature, with people who have concerns from the public health sector, on figuring out what is the scenario in which we don't affect anyone who doesn't want to be affected. And I think the truth of the matter is that's not the case right now. People are just doing it, right? I mean, we're not seeing people necessarily crying out loud on the front page of the Oregonian, but as you just noted, people are smoking cannabis everywhere, to a certain degree, because they have nowhere else to go. There's not one legal place, right? So, the other aspect is that, in general, in terms of secondhand smoke, cannabis is not tobacco. I'm not going to stand here and pretend to tell you that there aren't potentially some concerns. There was a study that was done that just came out about a month ago, citing every single study that's ever been done with cannabis smoke and in terms of secondhand smoke, saying that basically the number one side effects are you're going to have additional phlegm and coughing, but if you stop smoking, that those go away. It's really hard to find evidence beyond that compares it to any level in terms of tobacco. But again, you're not hearing me say that cannabis wants the same, rights as tobacco smokers necessarily. However, I do think it's really important to notice that when the Indoor Clean Air Act was last amended, the original bill did not contain cannabis. Cannabis was added at the last hour, and this was back in 2015, so in a short session when there were zero cannabis lobbyists, believe it or not, and it was tossed in. I don't think that there was ever any real intent from the champions of the Indoor Clean Air Act to include cannabis, but it was included probably because this was right when cannabis vape pen cartridges were coming out, and there was a real concern about confusing cannabis vape pens with real vape pens, and so let's just toss it in there so we have nothing to worry about. Now we're having to come back and kind of acknowledge that, and I think that there is, you know, a lot of questions that I have in terms of, well, should we really be treating it like cannabis? It's a catch-22 for me, because my opinion is that cannabis at least deserves the same exemptions that tobacco currently has under the law. Right now, cannabis is being treated as if it's worse than tobacco and there are no exemptions. This bill simply asks for a very specific exemption just for cannabis, and it's only for cities who want it. It doesn't even change anything otherwise, right? So that's kind of my pitch on the Indoor Clean Air Act part.
Well, and that's why I'm agreeing with you,
right,
and I
totally
like that idea. It's interesting that there are several bars in the Portland area that had designated, you know, since the Indoor Clean Air Act,
right,
they've gone out the back, they've put up, you know, plastic walls, mm-hmm, with open air,
right,
and heat lamps, and the only reason you would go out there is because you want to smoke a cigarette.
Right.
Nobody's going to just stumble out there.
I'm going to step in here. So huh? If we can have the questions go through me, that would be great. Go ahead and respond to that final question. I see that there are some questions over here, and then we need to transition to our next panel. Right. But it is a fascinating subject, and I'm glad to see that you're energized by it. Go ahead.
I don't think there was another question there, was there?
Would you like to ask a follow-up question about post?
Okay, sure. May I have a follow-up?
Yes, question? You may.
I forgot where I was.
We're on the same page.
Yes, good, we are path. On the same page. I want to see, like, what we've carved out,
right,
for, because right now cigarette smoking is being shut down all over the place. And you're right. I think cigarettes are more dangerous than secondhand smoke. Absolutely. But smoke in general is just,
right,
seen as smoke.
Totally on the same page.
For most people. So I wanted to agree with you on that. And, okay, and my question would be, just if, as we go forward with this, and I'm looking forward to this, is how we can set, because I want people to be able to go somewhere. Absolutely. I want that. But I want to see that same freedom for all smokers.
Thank you.
Okay. Excellent. All right. So thank you for that. We've got a number of additional questions. We have Rep. Marsh, and then Rep. Brocksmith, and then Rep. Reschke. Go ahead, Rep. Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a clarification and then a question. When you talk about cities being able to regulate these businesses with this, with similar time, place, and manner,
yes,
regulations that we had for dispensaries.
Chair Leininger, Rep. Marsh, that's exactly correct. Yes,
okay.
The same time, place, and manner regulations afforded under House Bill 3460 and 3400, which has historically been very broadly interpreted, which basically means it's totally up to the city how they want that. I've spoken with the OLCC about potential concerns that some localities might have. One would be, there are many commercial zones that abut residential zones. If a city had a serious concern about that, which I imagine some would, they could require that one of these cannabis lounges or temporary events needs to have a buffer between any residential. I think that's something that, you know, any reasonable business owner looking at obtaining these licenses would be willing to look at. And essentially, they could do the same things in terms of hours, zoning, buffers from parks, whatever it might be. They definitely have that ability.
Thank you. Second question.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. This one is about taxes. Now, when recreational product came on the market, it was taxed at 25%, mm-hmm, in 2016. The taxes have now dropped to a maximum of 20%, 17 at the state and 3 possibly at a local level. In front of the Revenue Committee is legislation that would allow a locality to vote to add another 5%, mm-hmm, getting us back up to the 25%. 25% worked in 2016. Do you think that's really any impediment in moving forward in 2017?
Chair Leininger, Representative Marsh, absolutely not. I am a firm believer that any additional tax over 20% after we have, let's look at the timeline. It's going to be 17 plus an additional 3 for whatever localities have passed that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to have 20% for the next year, and then we're going to up the taxes. I mean, if we have a serious concern about competing with the illegal market, that's the opposite of what we should be doing. It should, in my opinion, it should stay exactly where it is. It's going to force, the downtick in tax revenue that we're seeing is a direct result of some of the transition problems that we've been having, right? the next year is not necessarily going to be enough time for all of this transition to get smoothed out. There's a lot of other big concepts being floated around about consolidation of medical and recreational, and that's not going to happen overnight. That will take time to pan out. You know, 2 or 3 years down the road, after we've seen a legitimate plateau of the industry and hopefully maybe another spike with tourism and other opportunities for that, I think maybe there's a conversation to be had about, okay, let's recalibrate where the tax level is. But recalibrating it within a year of settling the tax number doesn't make much sense to me from an industry market perspective, because we still don't quite know exactly what's happening. And changing the tax revenue, while I am totally for incentivizing as many localities to come online as possible, because we do have a checkerboard right now of where this is allowed and where it's not, I do think that it would be a mistake to raise the taxes anytime in the next 2 years. I would want to see what the market really looks like 2 years from now, and we could make appropriate changes at that time.
Okay, well said. All right, Rep. Brocksmith, and then we'll go to Rep. Reschy.
Thank you, and I appreciate the presentation. I have not had a chance to fully review Senate Bill 307. I usually don't until they come over on this side with other committees. I don't have the time. I do have some questions with regards to it, though. As a former bar owner, you know, employees and owners have to go through strict OLCC trainings. You know, we call it, of course, VIP. Does the bill, or would the bill, or is it your position that you would be adding these, as it was mentioned earlier, the smoking sections, if you will, that would allow marijuana to be consumed on licensed OLCC liquor established business?
Chair Leininger, Representative Brocksmith, no. That was something that the OLCC was very specific about, and I totally agree in terms of a philosophy of incrementalism, is that right now it does not make sense to combine those two. There's a lot of questions. I imagine law enforcement would have a lot of questions if and when that conversation comes up. This would be completely separate from any licensed premise that serves alcohol right now.
Good.
Yes, please.
Thank you. And thank you for that, because it's hard enough to tell for a visually intoxicated person and for staff, even with the extensive training that occurs. And right, if they were to step out for a quick smoke, it would be, and come back in and order that highball again, it could be more difficult. And then secondly, you talked about the difficulties with a lot of folks being able to consume, because they might have live in a rental unit or what have you. And you mentioned Section 8 housing and, you know, federal housing, of course. But what about rental units with regards to, you know, if I had a rental that you were renting from me, mm-hmm, and it was in the rental agreement, of course, there will be no smoking in the unit. Can you explain to me how would this affect? Because I believe property owners,
right,
should have the ability to say, hey, so this, right, doesn't have any effect on that as well?
Chair Leininger, Representative Brocksmith, no, absolutely not, and I totally agree with you. This would create a legal space for those people to go. This would not legalize or change anything within their lease agreements. This would not upend any abilities of landlords to put what they want in their leases. I think that's something that they should absolutely have the right to have. This simply creates a legal space for people to go to consume if they choose to.
Thank you.
Great. Rep. Reschy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a comment and then a quick question.
Go ahead.
Both real quick. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Porter and Mr. Chapman, for coming. My comment is, some people are going to think I'm high when I say this, but I do agree with you that lower taxes does lead to greater revenue, especially with an elastic product like you're saying. So on the record, we agree on that. My question, though, is what percentage of Oregon sales are intended for recreational use versus medical use, or is the industry structured in such a way that you can track that kind of data?
Chair Leininger, Rep. Reschy, you know, it's a good question. I think the vast share of revenue that's coming in right now is from adult use. I think that the OLCC, that question may be better posed to the OLCC. I do not have those stats in front of me at the moment. However, I can tell you that the amount of dispensaries that stayed just medical are very few and far between. Anyone who had the ability to jump into the adult use market has probably done so. I think it's less than 5% have not made that change. I suspect that will go down to 1% as they realize that there will not be much profit margins on the medical side, whether it be, you know, patients are growing their own medicine, they're used to paying very, very, very low prices for that medicine. And, you know, I think it's it goes without noting that cannabis patients can still purchase tax-free at adult use stores. But I think that in general, as I mentioned before, there are plenty of adults who are using cannabis for health reasons or medicinally that would have never signed up under the medical program. They didn't want to be associated with it. It was, they were concerned about being on a list. They're part of a program. You know, we're seeing, you know, I've got a friend's grandmother who uses cannabis oil for her arthritis. Now, it doesn't get her high. It helps her her tremors. Right. And I think over time, you know, the legalization of adult use cannabis is the best thing that could have ever happened to people looking for medicinal relief in general. And so I think while it may be hard to parse out those numbers right now, over time, to whatever degree the OLCC can legally track patients purchasing medicine, they will do so. And if I hear of any new numbers, I'll be sure to bring it back to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Adam Crawford is also the committee administrator for the Joint Marijuana Regulation Committee, and he just passed me a note indicating that 85% of the total economic activities in the recreational market and 15% is in the medical market. And as Mr. Chapman noted, because there's no sales tax on medical purchases, the revenues, you know, tax revenue is 100% from the adult use market.
Thank you.
Okay, great. So thank you both very much. I mean, this is a fascinating subject. You know, the whole industry is fascinating. And I think Mr. Chapman rightly notes that there is not unanimity within the Oregonians about how to move forward on social consumption, but he did a great job of setting forth some of the arguments in favor, and there are really responsible, thoughtful people in the medical communities and the public health communities who feel strongly about the Indoor Clean Air Act. So the conversation continues, and I want to be respectful of all perspectives on that, but I like how you identified that there is an economic opportunity here that makes sense to a lot of us, and it's an instance in which Rep. Post and I are perhaps on the same page, which possibly doesn't happen on every issue. So there you go.
More than you think.
More often. Okay, thanks, gentlemen. And we are going to invite up, we're going to close the informational hearing on tourism in Oregon, of which the social consumption discussion was a part. And we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2143, Oregon Outdoor Recreation Day, and invite Representative Johnson, who's been very patient, thank you, to come forward and introduce the bill. And Mr. Crawford, could you describe the bill first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2143 designates the second Saturday of June as Oregon Outdoor Recreation Day, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. We do have a -1 committee amendment in front of the committee that designates the first Saturday of June as Oregon Outdoor Recreation Day. This bill, the -1 amendment, has neither a fiscal nor a revenue impact.
All right. So, Representative Johnson, please go ahead and introduce the bill, and then we have a number of people signed up to testify. We look forward to hearing from all of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Leininger, and Vice Chairs. Appreciate being here, committee members. Great to see you. And we will continue on the vein of talking about tourism and the role it can in tourism and recreational opportunities throughout the state, and what we can do here is within the legislature to try to build on the efforts of what others have had before us. So I was privileged and really just had a special relationship. Opportunity as a kid to grow up in the shadow of Mount Hood. And Rep. Helm knows what I'm referring to when I say I grew up in the upper valley of Hooter, little town of Parkdale. And outdoor recreation was always a key part of my life and for those that I grew up with and the families that we grew up with. Hunting, fishing, hiking, skiing, boating, water skiing on the Columbia on those sometimes rare and occasional calm days in the summer. Were typical recreational pursuits for me and my family and those that we grew up with. I've had a chance to watch the mix of recreational activities in my area change dramatically over the years. Now, in addition to the previous activities I mentioned, we boast world-class mountain biking, road biking, windsurfers and kiteboarders fill the Columbia on those days that the rest of us used to curse because it was too windy to do anything productive. And on calm days, stand up paddleboarders now jam the river from shore to shore, sharing the river with water skiers and so forth. All that to say that outdoor recreation has changed the gorge in the Mount Hood region in a very dramatic way. There are no more shoulder seasons for businesses in Hood River. Recreation enthusiasts now fill our shops and restaurants year-round. And they join those that come to enjoy our first-class pubs and wineries, and we've created a sustainable business environment that is raising standards of living throughout our region. But we aren't alone. I'm sure that the Bend and Central Oregon folks would say the same thing about what outdoor recreation has done for their area and for their economies. And I know my colleague down here from the coast would probably second that he's had a chance to see how outdoor recreation now is not just fun things to do, but they're actually economic drivers for the regions, and especially for the state of Oregon. I'll mention, go back to the example from Central Oregon. Some of you are familiar with the OSU Cascades campus that is growing and expanding in Bend, and they are now going to be able to offer a major, a degree pathway in outdoor recreation product design. So it shows you that outdoor recreation is not just having fun. It's about business, and it's about shining a light on this wonderful state. I've also had the opportunity to serve on a Travel Oregon task force over the interim called Outdoor Recreation Means Business. And it does in every sense of the word, because outdoor recreation now is a $12 billion a year business for the state of Oregon. What we can do, and what we're focusing on in this task force, is what we can do to maintain our progress and how we can help other parts of the state share in the economic potential that some of our regions now are so blessed to have. Because I feel it, and I've said this on multiple occasions, I think we've gotten this far as a state regarding outdoor recreation primarily based on good looks. We're a great state, we've got a lot of opportunities, and people have found us, and we've had some great marketing through Travel Oregon as well, certainly. But in order for us to continue to build on where we are and to maintain what we've accomplished, I really think it's going to take a much more intentional effort going forward. Because there are infrastructure needs that we need to think about. There are parts of our state right now that have incredible potential, but they just don't have tourist-related infrastructure to support people that want to come and recreate. And I'll point to the South Coast as one of those areas where if we had some additional tourist-related infrastructure, they too could become the next gorge or the next Mount Hood region in terms of a destination for people to visit. And we also have issues coming up regarding liability that we need to be able to take care of as well. It's going to take an intentional effort there to make sure we continue to have access to public lands and that our private sector owners have the ability to run their businesses and to maintain their way of life. So the first step in this process is going to be what you'll find in the bill before you today, and it simply does this. It declares the first Saturday of June as Outdoor Rec Day in Oregon. It's a time for all Oregonians to come together to share our value for fresh air, for recreation, for experiencing our vast, abundant natural resources, and to do this collectively. And as we do so, I think it's going to open up opportunities for us to have conversations about what we need to do to continue to be able to make our state a world-class destination, how we can share what we've learned with the younger generations, the benefits of being able to engage in outdoor recreation, the health benefits. So there's going to be a huge educational component. But I think it's just going to be a really great opportunity to shine the light on and take an intentional first step towards making outdoor recreation a key component, not just of Oregon's way of life, but making sure that it remains a key component of Oregon's economy going forward. And that obviously is something that you as a committee are focused on. So with that, I will move off of the stage here. And I know you have some other panels to come up. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you might have some, Madam Chair.
Looks like Rep. Gomberg has got a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for really bringing forward a bill that really, really focuses in on the economic drivers for very much of the state. My question for you is this: you spoke about the fresh air that Oregonians want to get out and enjoy. On June 1st, the first weekend in June, in much of the state, that fresh air is also damp air, and I'm wondering if there's something magical about the first weekend in June, or whether there are other dates that might be. Might have a broader impact on our state and its geography as well as its atmospherics.
Thank you for the question, Representative. Appreciate that. Magical? No. We've had actually a couple other opportunities. We picked a few other dates. One of them was a date that was had other connotations that we might not want to run up the flagpole and focus on. There are various dates that have secured places in some sectors in terms of what they mean. We originally had picked the second Saturday in November, and there were some conflicts with that date as well, so we're back to the first Saturday. But for I can't speak to your area in the coast. For much of the region, you have to kind of get to June before people feel good about getting outside, depending on the year. Sometimes in our neck of the woods, we say, you know, the first day of summer is July 5th. It's just hard to know sometimes. So it seems like a good opportunity. School's almost out. The weather is generally great, at least on, certainly it should be improving significantly by that time of year. So nothing magical about the date, but it seems like a good opportunity, especially if we talk about the springboard to the summer season and people are making camping plans and outdoor recreation plans for the summers as that time comes. So appreciate the question.
Thank you.
Rep. Rocksmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Johnson, appreciate the bill. You're exactly right. Recreation is a driving force in our state's economy. In my district, we, and I worked with great people for over 2 years, but we designated the first scenic bikeway on the coast out of North Craig County in Port Orford. In fact, a few weeks ago, I showed some videos of that we produced down in our district on recreation and bringing folks to the area. So I just want to thank you for your work on this and moving things forward and really getting it in people's minds that, especially in the beginning of the summer months, you know, it's time to get outdoors. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. You know, and working with this task force with Travel Oregon, there are some really, really exciting ideas that some folks are working on, i.e., one is to create a mountain bike trail through the entire state where you can go from destination to destination as you talk about navigating from, let's just say, Lakeview Burns all the way up to Astoria and have a way to actually navigate that. And it's very popular in other in Europe and so forth. You go to yurt or hut to hut type stuff, but if we had to set up a highway like that, it could actually navigate its way through eastern Oregon or the Cascades up through the valley somehow. So those are just some ideas, but there's a lot of really smart people thinking about ways we can continue to build on what we're doing. There's a great opportunity. In fact, Timberline Lodge is hopefully going to begin work this summer on a lift-assisted mountain bike trail system, similar to what Whistler has up in BC, which is an absolute world-class destination. If that would happen, be able to get up and running, I mean, it'll put the Northwest on the map as a mountain biking mecca where folks will come spend a week in Whistler, spend a week on Mount Hood and so forth, and while they're there, they're doing all kinds of other activities, and obviously these folks like to spend money and enjoy the other amenities that we offer in the state as well. So we're at a really good place. We just need to continue to be intentional about what we're doing.
Great. Excellent. Any other comments, questions? Okay, great. So thank you,
Rep.
Johnson. And then we'll have a few individuals come up. We have Sally Russell. Sally Russell is here from over 100 miles. I wanted to give folks who are new on the committee information or new to the legislature information about the fact that we try to make sure that people who've traveled from over 100 miles get to come up for sure, that there's never inadequate time, and also try to call them early in a meeting. Then let's also have Adam Baylor and Jim Gardner, please. You can begin in any order, but please state your name for the record and welcome.
Good morning, Chair Leininger and committee members. I'm Sally Russell. I'm the mayor pro tem for the Bend City Council, and I did wake up to a starry sky in the morning, and I drove through a raging snowstorm, and now I'm enjoying the rain and sort of the damp environment. So on any given day, the weather can be really different throughout Oregon. And I want to thank Representative Johnson for sort of his beautiful entry into this conversation about recreation and all the ways it really supports our community. And I was thinking back as I was driving across the past this morning of a day in 1992 when I was actually writing a grant proposal that went to Travel Oregon, or its precursor, to bring the 5-stage Cascade Cycling Classic that I was director of to Oak Ridge. as our state was really trying to move beyond the timber-based economy and begin to bring tourism and specifically road bikes and then mountain bikes, and how our state has really changed in these past 25, 30 years. I'm here with the unanimous support of the Bend City Council, and given our very diverse points of view, sometimes that's a miracle, but we all agree that the Oregon Outdoor Recreation Day is really something that's very appropriate for our region as well as our state. So, of course, as we've discussed, we're known for outdoor activities, and I want to say, too, that as much as people come to Bend to play on the snow and in our rivers and on our mountains and enjoy our cities, we also go to different places in Oregon. So we'll kiteboard in the Columbia Gorge or down on the southern Oregon coast. A lot of people go from Bend, and they actually will go surfing on the Oregon coast. So a lot of it, I think it's important for us to realize that once people are in Oregon, they enjoy sort of all the different ways we can enjoy the state, and that's important for us. I also want to mention that Bend's proximity to public lands, including the Deschutes National Forest, is the cornerstone of its lifestyle and economy. And certainly many people in Oregon and throughout the world choose Bend as a tourist destination. And many ultimately choose to move to Bend to live, work, and play. So outdoor recreation, especially in Bend and Central Oregon, is part of our daily life. And it's also about livability. When I worked on Senator Wyden's Committee for Recreation Assets in Deschutes County about 10 years ago now, we talked a lot about developing healthier lifestyles, which result often in reduced health care system expenses, and certainly awareness of natural areas, wildlife ecosystems, which then results in protection of water and air, are really important values. One of the great benefits of having such great recreation at our doorstep is the growth and development of companies based on the outdoor recreation industry. And I want to sort of focus on that today.
And
to give
and
you
Mayor,
an idea of the
economic... Mayor, may I jump in for one second,
yes,
please? So we're hoping to work this bill, and then we have one other bill we're hoping to work today. And I
okay.
know our social consumption conversation went long, but if you could wrap up in the next maybe 2 minutes, that'd be great.
Cool.
And then if
Thank
everyone
you.
Else could speak for maybe 3-4 minutes max, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I did hear some longer. So let me just say in Bend, specifically in the outdoor recreation businesses, we have 100 outdoor companies. We currently have 535 jobs in the outdoor industry and $25 million in wages. And at a recent EDCO Pub Talk, Hydro Flask General Manager Scott Allen talked about the $30.3 million sales in the last 3 months, and it sailed Helen of Troy. So we have a burgeoning, growing outdoor industry product group, and that's really that we're now beginning to take tourism and our focus on the outdoor industry and really grow. And I want to say again, the designation of this day begins to focus on the value of the outdoors and all the ways that it comes back to feed our economy as well as our communities socially.
Thank you so much.
That.
It's
Thank
really exciting what you're doing and what all the community members in Central Oregon are doing to create some exciting new sectors.
Yeah, and certainly this Travel Oregon Outdoor Recreation Means Business Initiative, which I'm part of, and all the different ways we come together throughout the state to really create strategies and bring us forward as a state is very exciting.
Thank you so much. Please go ahead, start by stating your name for the record, and then let us know what you're thinking, and then we'll have questions for the panel at the end.
Thank you, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. My name is Adam Baylor. I work for the Mazamas based in Portland, Oregon. I'm the stewardship and advocacy manager. So I work on trail maintenance projects and do advocacy work like here today to support HB 2143. We teach a couple hundred people to play in the mountains safely. We lead about 1,000 hikes and climbs throughout Oregon and actually throughout the entire Cascade Range. So looking at this bill on just elevating the importance of outdoor recreation is really why we're here to support this today. And another point that I do want to make is that, you know, besides the economic impact of outdoor recreation is the jobs. It's 141,000 jobs in outdoor recreation industry throughout the whole state. And as a somebody who's employed by an outdoor recreation organization, I've been there for 4 years now. So we have to really kind of think about how to elevate that, and this bill is one of those steps. And a colleague here with the Outdoor Industry Association can highlight a lot of those economic statistics for you. So one of the, I think the key things that we look at this bill as is once we make the step to elevate outdoor recreation, what are the next steps for the rest of the year, for the future? And we're really thrilled to be working with Representative Johnson, Representative Helm, on creating an Office of Outdoor Recreation in the state of Oregon and an advisory council and an outdoor recreation fund so that we can actually look at access issues and look at the problems that outdoor recreation organizations like nonprofits and for-profit businesses in the sector face every year, whether it's attracting new businesses to the state of Oregon, whether it's really just how to get more people outside. So we look forward to working on not just this bill, other bills, and trying to figure out a way forward. Lastly, I just want to leave you with a bit of news. You maybe have read the outdoor retailer show in Salt Lake City has had some complications. And if you look at what other places this outdoor retailer show could be hosted, could Portland be one of those places? And I think it could. I think that we have to really consider a place like Salt Lake is 10,000 hotel rooms every year is filled by this outdoor retailer show. Could we bring something like that to Oregon? We have Columbia, we have REI, we have some heavy hitters in the outdoor rec world, and we have a ton of nonprofits that are really dedicated to getting people outside. So I think there's a really good balance, and this bill sends a strong message to all Oregonians that we are leaders in outdoor recreation, and we're going to continue to do that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate that you brought up the outdoor industry opportunity, the trade show opportunity. That seems really important and a kind of an urgency to our signaling that we're a leader in and we care a lot about outdoor recreation. Mr. Gardner, welcome.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Outdoor Industry Association, which is the sponsor of that trade show that you mentioned. And our organization represents not only major manufacturers and retailers like REI and Columbia Sportswear, but a number of smaller companies as well that do business and are located throughout the state of Oregon. I'm going to keep my testimony very short and just draw your attention to the fifth whereas in the bill, which really documents the numbers that are associated with the presence of this industry in Oregon. $12.8 billion in consumer spending, that's in Oregon. 141,000 direct Oregon jobs that pay $4 billion in wages and salary a year and provide approximately $950 million in state and local tax revenue. It's a big industry. It's a kind of a unrecognized giant, if you will, and we are so grateful to those of you, Representative Johnson, Representative Helm, on the other issue that we were talking about, for and to you, Madam Chair, for showing leadership on this issue. It's really important that we build this cluster in Oregon, and we're going to build it on a great base that already exists. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much for being here. And we have Arthur Towers signed up to provide testimony also. And then I would entertain a motion on the bill, if there is one. Do you want to go now?
After our Arthur, please. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, the political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And we support the bill as written or with the amendment that is offered as the committee sees fit. But we want to come testify today because we also want to make sure that the outdoor recreation industry is as safe as possible, too, and is accountable for that safety. We've had an excellent chance to partner with the agritourism industry in 2015 to enact legislation to make sure that those opportunities for families to recreate are safe and the industry is held accountable for safety. And we're enthusiastic about legislation we worked on with Representative Gomberg last session around a burning issue and the issue of recreational safety. This session we are involved in a couple different bills, House Bill 2854 and Senate Bill 504 around playground safety, which is somewhat tangential but certainly related. And then House Bill 2716 and Senate Bill 643 around safety in whitewater rafting, requiring children to wear helmets while whitewater rafting in dangerous waters. And so to that end, we are very supportive of the bill. We look forward to working with the industry to make sure that it's as safe as possible. Again, we enjoyed our partnership with the agritourism industry. We were disappointed that we were on opposite sides with the rafting industry around children wearing helmets in when the bill was heard last week in Senate committee. But with that, I'll close my testimony. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Representative Helm.
Well, thank you, Arthur. And actually, this goes maybe to the bill itself. And I don't know if this is the right time, but or I don't want to raise a sore subject, but I just noticed that in the previous bill that we talked about, Senate Bill 307, with respect to this bill, I hope that we move it along as fast as possible. It's going to be a great thing for Oregon to have an outdoor recreation day. If we threw an emergency clause on Senate Bill 307 and work that through the building, it could be ready in time for June, early June. Just something to think about.
That's a very helpful comment. Thank you, Rep. Helm. So you're talking about Senate Bill 307, different bill, but you're noting that that might be an instance where you feel like an emergency clause would be useful.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks very much. You don't need to speak to that unless you feel like you want to. But
Madam Chair, since I don't know what Representative Helm's talking about, I'll pass.
That's
Thank
a wise
you.
Choice. Okay. Thank you so much. All right. So now we will thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2143 and ask if my vice chair has a motion.
I do, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Leininger, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated February 23rd, 2017.
Vice Chair Brocksmith has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 23rd, 2017. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? If not, that they are adopted.
Madam Chair Leininger, I move House Bill 2143 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2143 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Rep. Marsh.
Yes, I just wanted to add sort of a broad comment wrapping in all of today's testimony. I come from Southern Oregon, where our primary tourist attraction is the Shakespeare Festival, not outdoor, not cannabis related. But we understand that there are only so many seats and so many shows that people can go to. So in order to build our tourist economy to make sure that people stay one more night in Ashland, we look to Mount Ashland, we look to our scenic bikeways, we look to the Rogue River, and maybe we'll want to look at the cannabis industry if that option is allowed to us. The point being, the way we grow the health and economic development of our tourist sector is to pick up all pieces of this, because no piece is independent of the other. It's all sort of essentially a tapestry that attracts people to come here and to stay for a longer period of time.
That's a great comment. Thank you. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a good bill, and I'll support it with enthusiasm. And I would even support its early implementation. But I think the emergency clause here highlights a broader problem we have, and that is that while it's worthwhile to implement bills like this on an early date, they certainly have nothing to do with the public safety, health, and welfare of Oregon. They simply need to be implemented earlier. And the only phrase that we are allowed under the Oregon Constitution is to call that an emergency and move forward. Representative Post and I have introduced legislation that would change that phrasing so that Oregonians don't get confused and see this is a good bill, but it's not an emergency.
Okay.
So any other comments? I'll say that I'm really excited about the idea that this bill helps signal to the outdoor tourism sector, as there are people considering whether to move an important trade show to our community, that we really stand behind trying to be strong and productive hosts to that kind of event. So definitely bring it here together with those 10,000 hotel nights, please. Any objections to adopting the moving the bill forward as amended with a due pass recommendation to the floor? Seeing none, the bill passes. And I believe it would be appropriate to have Representative Johnson be the carrier, so we'll do that. Thank you so much. So closing the work session on House Bill 2143, I'd like to try to open a work session on House Bill 2325. And Mr. Crawford, if you could briefly explain what that bill is about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2325 removes all 9 members from the Oregon Travel Information Council on June 30th, 2018, allows members removed to be reappointed, modifies terms of the council members so that no more than 3 terms expire on the same date starting June 30th, 2018, directs the council members to hire and supervise an executive director. There is neither a revenue nor a fiscal impact statement on this bill.
All right. Thank you so much. We have 2 people signed up to testify, and if it's possible, we can perhaps work the bill today. So let's invite Nancy D'Souza and Gwen Baldwin forward from the Travel Information Council. Both are appearing here in support of the bill. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and let us know what you're thinking, and I'll let the committee members know this is the last day to introduce committee bills, so we're hoping to very briefly introduce a couple of committee bills at the end of our hopefully work session on this bill.
Chair Leininger and members of the committee, I'm Nancy D'Souza, for the record, Executive Director of the Travel Information Council.
And for the record, I'm Gwen Baldwin. I serve as chair of the Travel Information Council.
So in respect of your time, we'll keep this really brief. The Travel Information Council and our agency operating name is Oregon Travel Experience. We are responsible for the Blue Highway logo sign program up and down the highways that say gas, food, lodging, wineries. We operate 29 rest areas around the state at 17 locations for the Oregon Department of Transportation. We have the Heritage Tree Program and the Historical Marker Program. So our small agency touches every area of the state, and we are fortunate in the agency to be governed by a council of 9 members, 8 of whom are appointed by the governor, and 1 is a representative of the Transportation Commission. And because of the way the statute was originally carved out from the transportation statutes in the 70s, there wasn't a provision for staggering of terms, and some turnover in 2012 led us to have 6 of our 8 governor-appointed positions come up for renewal the same day last year. And that's creating, you know, just some challenges that we'd like to clarify for the future to ensure continuity of leadership and continuity of knowledge among our council members, because they are actively involved in governing the agency and take that responsibility seriously. While we were looking at the statutes, we also found that there was a little bit of murkiness in the governing language itself, in that it referred to both the council, its governing body, and the agency as the council. And so the language that we had submitted to the governor and she has proposed on our behalf clarifies that and allows us to stagger the terms, just out of an abundance of caution, to make sure that the executive director knows who their supervisors and bosses are. So,
excellent. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Leininger, Vice Chairs Brock Smith and Marsh. My name again is Gwen Baldwin. I serve as the chair of the Travel Information Council, and I have done so since my appointment back in 2012. Oh, gosh, that is a long time. And I'm still here. And in that capacity, I work with our executive director and with the governor's office to ensure the robust mix of members of the governing council. And it's complex. As you saw, we have a fairly diverse range of work that our agency undertakes. And so it's a really important sort of stew to meld regional expertise, experience in all sorts of different sectors, again, geographic diversity. And so having staggered terms gives us some breathing room to try to do that in a way that not only creates that more readily, but also ensures that we have institutional governance stability.
In terms of the governing language, I really want to emphasize that this is an honor and a privilege to serve the citizens of Oregon in the volunteer leadership capacity as a member of the governing body of a semi-independent agency. And as such, we want to make sure that at all times we are ensuring the best value for the Oregon taxpayer and the best experience for the Oregon visitor and traveler. And so we think it's important when you've got murky language to clear it up, clean it up, and we're taking that opportunity today. So we encourage your support for the bill.
Thank you so much. All right. Are there any questions for the panel on this bill? If not, I would welcome a motion on
this bill. Madam Chair Leininger, I move House Bill 2325 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Pardon me. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2325. Please, if you could say that again.
Thank you, Chair Leininger. I move House Bill 2325 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Brock Smith moves House Bill 2325 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries, and we will move House Bill 2325 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Marsh, would you like to carry that?
Sure.
Great. All right. Closing a work session on that, and as our final act for today, thank you very much for being here and for presenting that common sense adjustment to our regulations. We have a few committee bills that we are introducing and would love to have be accepted as committee bills on this, the last day to do that. Mr. Crawford, if you could briefly describe them, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, LC 3624 and 3625 are placeholder bills relating to trade for use by the committee if and when they need it. We also have LC 3922 as a tax credit bill related to repair of durable goods, the labor otherwise paid for them.
All right, so with that, I'm going to open a work session on the introduction of committee bills, and note for the record that approving the introduction of a committee bill is not synonymous with vowing to support it on the merits, but rather it's deemed to be a courtesy for the conversation moving forward. And with that, I'd welcome a motion.
Madam Chair Leininger, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 3624, dated January 13, 2017; LC 3625. Dated January 13, 2017, LC 3922, dated February 20th, 2017.
Vice Chair Brock Smith moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 3624, LC 3625, and LC 3922. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. Is there any further business before the committee today? All right, thanks everyone. Appreciate the good conversation. The meeting is adjourned. All right, thanks everyone.